Hi, I'm Jason Chung, head of the esports practice at Zuberlawler.
And I'm Philip Milestone, counsel at Zuberlawler. Zuberlawler is a law firm, and like any good lawyers, we have a big disclaimer for you. We are lawyers, but we're not your lawyers.
Until you pay us.
So everything here is for entertainment purposes only.
Again, until you pay us.
This podcast is brought to you by virtualtimes.com. Virtualtimes.com, your news from the metaverse.
Welcome, MetaSapiens, to What the Meta. And this year is a very special episode. We'll be discussing the wrap up of 2023 and looking ahead. So we want to focus on distributed ledger technology and where it's going to go in the future. So, Philip, how are you feeling?
I feel good. Generally, emotionally, and about distributed ledger technology. DLT is doing really interesting things, for sure. The obvious is that Bitcoin is what was at all-time highs recently, and now it's doing its thing, sort of bumping around between 65 and 69. Bitcoin is sort of it's not distributed ledger technology, you know, of it. I'm sorry, it is an example of it, but it's not the only example of it. There are many others. I was actually just in Denver last week for the Ethereum Denver conference, and I mean, in general, the energy there was just spectacular. People are very excited. I mean, I think certainly the BTC price has a good chunk to do with that, but Ethereum is different than Bitcoin. And that ecosystem is raging. There was a lot of really fun projects. This is my second year. I was a mentor there for their hackathon, their Biddle-a-thon. And that was super fun. A lot of the projects were just, they're ambitious, they're excited. So I think the energy is great. 2023, you know, rounding out 2022's terrible year, was quite an adventure. And I think it was a great time to talk about sort of the end of 2023 and entering into 2024 with Josh, who, for the record, was also at ETH Denver. Doing his thing. And he's also, you know, a big player in distributed ledger technology and a real advocate for this new style of computing. So I think we timed this episode perfectly, right when 2023 was ending, right when Bitcoin was looking good, but hadn't gone bananas. And it's just, I'm very excited for the industry, for the technology, and for the future. I think we I hope we're turning a corner, but certainly I'm seeing big excitement, and that in and of itself is a huge achievement.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Phil, because I do see the excitement. I see it from coming from a slightly different place this time, whereas before it was felt like, okay, we're going to go to the moon. Not to borrow from Dogecoin too much, but we're going to go to the moon. We're going to do all this kind of stuff. It's going to be a rocket ship for money. And I'm seeing a renewed focus, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you saw something different in Denver, but I'm seeing a renewed focus on the actual technology and what it can actually bring and what it can actually do. And so that actually fills me with more confidence going forward, rather than, you know, I think all the things that we talk about with Josh, but also we talked about it internally as well, right? About, you know, hey, is this a speculative, rocket ship that you're investing in, or is it an actual cool technology that will lead to real impacts and real changes in our lives? So, yeah, I definitely think there's optimism, but very different this year compared to last, I think.
I mean, I think you're right. We, over the past 18 months or so, we've seen folks accused, you know, alleged wrongdoers, some would say wrongdoers, brought to heel. You know, they've been caught. You know, I think there's been a lot of scams, a lot of misuse of technology that have ruined a lot of lives, and that's awful. But those scammers were real, and to the extent we are cleaning that up as an industry, that's a great thing. And I think the narrative, the framework you're discussing, was is well put and insightful. I've heard it described most recently by Chris Dixon in his new book, Read, Write, Own, as sort of the casino mindset versus the computer mindset. Casino mindset is sort of where we were, right? Hey, like you said, to the moon, roll the dice, who knows? It's magic internet money is one of the t-shirts I picked up at ETH Denver. But the computer mindset is different, right? This is a thing. This is a technology. This is a new way of computing. It's a new way to network. And that in and of itself is, you know, Will it make money? It could, the same way the internet could, right? But the internet went through its own bubble, right? We're both old enough to remember pets.com. And that was, you know, also a time of swindles and bad ideas. So don't blame the technology for the ills of humanity. And hopefully we've cleared out some of the most egregious actors.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that. You know, it feels, you know, I'm getting old, though. So, you know, one of the benefits.
Welcome to the tribe, Jason.
I know, exactly. So, you know, thanks for greeting me. And I got to tell you, the one of the benefits and horrors is that you just see the same things happening over and over again, right? The terminology changes, the technology changes, but the attitudes of humans don't really change that much, right? And it reminds me of the early days of the internet where people were like, this is really cool. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and then they started fetishizing like parts of the technology, which are just things, you know what I mean? Or protocols rather than actually what you can do with it. And actually, you know, I find the internet these days, you know, very mature and, you know, useful and all that kind of stuff, but it's a lot more boring than it used to be. Right. And that boringness actually communicates the fact that we've re-entered a maturity. You know, we can monetize it properly. We know what it is, right? And there's something to be said for boring. And I'm hoping that we get there. And I know that the things that we discussed with Josh, and who we should say is one of the main partners at Zuber Lawler, you know, one of the things we talk about is all these exciting things and all these things that we're trying to figure out. But at the same time, I do get the sense, Philip, that we're starting to enter hopefully a little bit more boring, a little bit more settled, but we're still a long, long ways away, which is why, you know, you need attorneys. And, you know, of course, you know, attorney edge right here, right? So, yeah.
Tell me you're a lawyer without telling me you're a lawyer, right? Celebrating the brain state of any new technology. And I mean, I get that, right? Josh spends a good amount of time in this interview talking about the IRS, you know, and its approach to this new technology. And that's really important. I mean, death and taxes, right? The only two things that are ever certain. And taxation is real. You know, people argue about how much it should be and what it should accomplish and what it can't accomplish. But nonetheless, taxation is real. And to the extent this industry is growing up, that, you know, taxation is a necessary part of that. I think same thing with regulation. It comes along with mass adoption, right? I mean, the idea behind the SEC was supposed to protect consumers, right? That impetus isn't wrong, right? I certainly don't want to see people scammed out of money. How the SEC does that, different story entirely. We talk a little bit about that too. When we recorded this, we were talking about the biggest news events of 2023, and we certainly saw some big court cases come down. We might see some legislation this year that might not be great, might be great, who knows, right? But like you say, that I think is the sign of maturity, that you begin to draw the attention of the powerful. That happens when you are yourself powerful. And I think that, you know, great power should learn to coexist. It doesn't have to be lovey-dovey. It doesn't have to be hyper-contentious, right? It is possible to let an industry be and excel and innovate without letting it be the Wild West and without having it be locked down and stifled. So finding that middle ground, I think, is probably one of the big stories of 2024. I feel like I could have said the same thing at the beginning of 2023, but hopefully this year, you know, it's real. And I think one of the big differences is that we have traditional finance entering the decentralized finance world, right? That is a big shift. We have huge, huge traditional finance players now trading in ETFs, the core asset of which is Bitcoin. You know, Ethereum ETFs have existed in Canada for a while, you know, true north. And they might come to this country soon. We'll see. We've got European regulations. They've got their, I think it's called MiCA, and that's their stablecoin regulation. They're also dealing with digital assets. California has new laws coming on about, you know, digital assets and how they're going to be regulated. So I like that. Again, as boring lawyers, we see regulation and, you know, our lawyer brain says, ooh, you know, work. But on the other side, my technology brain, my evangelist brain says, you know, good. You know, let us have this talk. Let us have this debate. Will it end the way I want? Probably not. But, you know, the sign of a good compromise is everybody ends up equally unhappy. And if we can get there, that's better than we are now.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the radical things that I'll say for 2024 is I think it's time to uncouple sort of innovation with exciting or unhinged exciting. You know what I mean? Like, you can innovate. In fact, I would argue, and I say this completely self-servingly as an attorney, but like, I think you can be hugely innovative, yeah, right? Without necessarily being the most exciting thing in the world, right? From an outsider's point of view, but I still find it exciting, right? Because ultimately, having that conversation, it might bore some people to tears who are looking to monetize every second of their day. But at the same time, I think that that conversation is exciting because it leads to other sort of broader conversations we should have, which is, does this thing actually have utility? Is it sustainable? How does it fit into the system? Is it supposed to break the system? All these things that we are talking about, I feel like we've gotten here somewhat haphazardly, but you know, finally, I think all elements and all stakeholders are starting to get to the point where, hey, maybe we're sophisticated enough to actually have this conversation for real. And it doesn't need to be fetishized anymore in terms of technology. We can actually have, you know, a brass tack conversation about this as a tool, as a vehicle, as a technology. And you know, as Skynet 2.0, who knows, maybe. But I'll talk about AI overlords on a future episode. But for today, I think this sets up our conversation with Josh well. Any sort of final, you know, pearls of wisdom or anything like that before we throw to the interview?
Nah, my pearls of wisdom are still sand. But I will point out, I had sort of an interesting experience in two cars in East Denver, right? The event is in sort of one very large complex that normally holds livestock. But all over the city, there are side events here and there. And so to get around the city, you know, they have these little scooters, but you can also take cars. So I was in Lyft or Lime or Uber or whatever. And I had many drivers, but over the course of the week, there were two that stuck out. The first was a fellow who, when I got in the car, looked me straight in the eye, said, "Are you one of those expletive crypto bros?" I was like, "I try not to be, you know, just take me to the destination." And he said, "Yeah, you know, I lost $500 from that expletive Elon Musk, and I hate this expletive." He was not happy with the idea of crypto whatsoever. Mark Contrast was another fellow who's like, "Yeah, you know, I love this. If I wanted to move to Australia with 1,000 pounds of gold, I never could. But Bitcoin, man, I can totally do that." I mean, they're coming from different perspectives, but they were, you know, similar people. You know, they're in the same city, doing the same job, similarly situated. Their approach to this new technology was radically different. And I feel that at least those two points of view have to be brought into the fold. And everything in between is going to be an interplay between that type of emotion, that type of politics, that type of transferability, that type of power, that type of insight. And that's going to make 2024, among many other reasons, a very exciting time for distributed ledger technology. And I think our conversation with Josh really summed up last year well, and I think tees up this year well as well.
Absolutely. Glass and halfway with liquid. Is it full or is it empty? So with that, let's send that over to the interview with Josh. Hello, Meta Sapiens, and welcome back to What the Meta. Today, we're going to do an end of the year roundup to discuss distributed ledger technology. Where is it going? Where have we come from in 2023, and what are we going to do in 2024? So to discuss that with us today, we have a very special guest, Josh Lawler, of Zuber Lawler fame. Josh, if you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit to the Meta Sapiens out there, that'd be great.
Hello, Meta Sapiens. I'm Josh Lawler. And as Jason mentioned, I'm a named partner at the firm Zuber Lawler, which you guys probably know plenty about by now. But if not, we're a 50-attorney law firm in the United States, offices in several cities, another 400 or so people internationally. And we focus a lot on emerging areas of industry and technology, including, obviously, the metaverse, as well as areas that are near and dear to my heart, like distributed ledger technology, blockchain.
Perfect. Thank you, Josh. And, obviously, we have these discussions all the time about where the industry is going and, what the technology is like. But just to start us off nice and easy, 2023 was a pretty, let's say, tumultuous year, right? In terms of everything from valuations to regulations. What is, in your opinion, in your expert opinion, is like the biggest story of this year, and what kind of maybe flew under the radar a little bit, in your opinion?
Sure. So, you know, again, I'm a blockchain guy. So, you know, when you start talking about biggest stories, that's kind of where I'm going to probably go to. And, you know, by far, I think the most kind of public biggest story was the Ripple lawsuit with the SEC, where, of course, you know, Judge Torres in the Southern District basically found more or less entirely for Ripple. Not exactly, but the stuff that she found for the SEC was not the stuff of consequence. And that has caused even the SEC to back off of its position that every token was a security. That decision, while it may sound limited to, you know, securities law and blockchain, is actually really fundamental to many, many, many different things. Because what we actually have is, really for the first time I'm aware of, a court looking at technology going, okay, administrative body of the United States, it's not what you're saying it is just because you're saying it's that, it's something else. And I think that that has subsequently echoed across a lot of securities decisions in the blockchain space, but I think it's also going to take a fairly powerful kind of place within just the general pantheon of technology jurisprudence, because the reality is that every time something new comes out and the law doesn't fit, the administrative bodies try to squeeze it into something that used to exist, and it's usually a bad fit. So this was, I think, a huge one. So that's that one. On the under the radar stuff that is likely to have just tectonic types of movement, and it's just stuff nobody really thinks about because it's boring and technical. The IRS, and also to some degree, you know, the folks who put out the financial standards for FASB have taken some positions that are just untenable and irrational and logistically impossible in terms of required accounting and reporting in context of digital assets. And you know, what you're really looking at there is nothing short of the monetary system of the future, if I can put it that way. I mean, if you look at what your metaverse kind of worlds look like, or your metaverse in general, because I tend to think of them all as being connected and persistence being what defines metaverse. You know, if you've got certain standards being applied for taxation and for reporting that, you know, require somebody who doesn't have information to provide that information. So that's like calling a Bitcoin node operator a broker and saying they've got an obligation to report all the transactions they do when they don't know who's doing them. Or you've got something like the IRS's rule that would like to use FIFO accounting as first in, first out as their methodology for measuring gain on digital assets, where, you know, somebody who could have bought Ethereum out of the gate at 30 cents would then mean the next sale of Ethereum they make would have to be with their basis at 30 cents. And again, I don't want to get too into the weeds on that, other than to say, like, the accounting matters a lot. And I think that's going to be one of the big battles coming up.
Well, I like to get in the weeds a little bit, you know, so in terms of the accounting portion of it, right? You mentioned it's untenable and everything like that. And obviously there's different principles that are being applied to digital assets that maybe don't work, right? Where are we headed with that, right? I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, accounting is flexible, but it's also a regime. So what does that mean for this new world that we've got coming up?
I'm forgetting what book I read that had the Department of Creative Accounting as one of the linchmen, but that's really what it is. You know, for anybody who's not as familiar, you know, when you're talking about accounting, depending on kind of what kinds of assumptions and, you know, kind of rules you set out for certain things that do have multiple interpretations, is going to seriously affect your results. I mean, and you need to look no further than, you know, cash basis accounting versus accrual accounting, both of which are legal, but both of which give you very, very different results in terms of how much you might have to pay in taxes at a given point in time. So, you know, when you've got something for a digital asset, it says, you know, if you've got a fungible digital asset, it's first in, first out. What that means is, like, if I've been buying Bitcoin for the last 10 years and it's all been going into, you know, one wallet, which is not likely in that scenario, but nonetheless, that means no matter what happens, if I buy one today at $43,000 and then a minute later I sell one at $43,000, my taxable hit is going to be $43,000 less that first Bitcoin I bought, which might have been a dime. So I just got taxed on effectively $43,000 of capital gains income when I didn't actually make a cent. Now, the thing about that is that kind of announcement came out earlier this year, as I mentioned, not that long ago, kind of second half of this year. And meanwhile, you know, you've got the entire community has not been keeping track of things that way. So everybody's got wallets that are mixed. The only way you can manage that particular type of accounting is if you have a whole ton of different wallets so that you can allocate specifically what something went to, what something came back from. And that's just not the way things work. It also sets up just like chaos at any centralized exchange that is kind of pooling their customers' assets. Because as we've seen in FTX, the centralized exchanges, they're not allocating it based on, you know, each account holder. They have everything pooled into, you know, hot and cold wallets, which means that technically it's theirs, and the wallet, you know, their customers are unsecured creditors. It's not actually theirs unless, you know, custody is held a certain way. And that means, you know, when FTX goes bankrupt, you know, everybody shares in the same pool. You don't have your stuff isolated. But it also means that technically Coinbase, every time you buy or sell something, is also buying and selling something. And, you know, what that accounting looks like for a public company, I couldn't begin to tell you, but it's messy. All this stuff is messy. And then, you know, to understand really the breadth of it, you know, putting it into kind of a metaverse context, you know, that is also going to go for in-game assets. That is also going to go for virtual real property. You know, any of the, you know, medium of exchange tokens. So, you know, your sand, your mana, any of those types of things. It all's going to go to the same place, because at the end of the day, you're still paying tax to whatever sovereign you happen to pay tax to, and they still want to count it. And they really don't know how. I mean, that's the real problem.
It's an interesting problem. And before we sort of talk about solutions, I want to ask you specifically about NFTs.
Okay.
I saw an article the other day, and just talking about sort of the difficulty in characterizing assets from a regulatory standpoint, I think there's a similar and corresponding difficulty from media in misunderstanding things. So I'm going to toss a softball, because I really, when I saw this article, I wanted to get your take on it. Marketplace. It's a show on NPR. It's great. Kai Ryssdal, shout out. Love you, Kai. He had a headline up there. It said, is this the death of the NFT? Digital art market tanks, right? And I saw the headline. Yeah, that was my reaction. And I was about to respond online, and I realized that arguing on the internet is, you know, not a winning proposition. So I left it alone. But just with the headline, right? And I don't want to call out Marketplace. By all means, listen to the show. It's great.
No.
What's your reaction there?
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to call it Marketplace, because they're in line with 95% of the world. So that's not their fault. But it is something that I think is going to change massively in 2024. One of my pet peeves in general is, you know, the popular vernacular linking onto a term that it hears and then thinking it means something more than what it is. And just because I have to say it, because my head will explode if I don't. Number one example, staking. It starts out as something that you're putting something at stake. So it's at risk because you are providing compute resources to a protocol. And for that, you get paid. And somehow within a period of months that changed into you're providing something and getting paid, which is basically a savings account. And so now it's all staking. We differentiate between protocol staking and yield staking. NFT as a term is maybe even the worst example of that thing. And it's natural. People, you know, try to grasp for things that they can understand. So NFT means non-fungible token. And in the same way that every fungible token is not a security just because it's a token, every non-fungible token is not a piece of art on a JPEG just because it's a non-fungible token. What it really is a snippet of software code that is the product of a function taken over a smart contract, where the smart contract is something that sits typically perfectly visible, immutable on a blockchain. And the NFT can represent any asset or any number of assets, and it can have any number of different use cases at the same time. I'll get to that in a second. So it's a very broad, flexible thing. Really more akin to like a piece of paper. You know, what is a piece of paper? Well, it depends what's written on it. Fair enough. What is an NFT? Well, it really depends what it's set to represent. That's really all it is media that represents. So that's a hard concept for people to get, no question. But meanwhile, the tip of the spear on NFTs was, you know, Bored Ape. It's Doodles. It's, you know, it's CryptoPunks. It's CryptoKitties. Actually, really, is the real tip of the spear, I guess. And that's easy for the population to understand. So the shorthand becomes, oh, hey, NFTs, got it. It's that JPEG and by the way, they're trying to get away from being a security. So they're saying it's got intellectual property rights that come along with it and check your terms and conditions, and it can get you into a party and, you know, whatever. And of course, that market, as we all know, really tanked. And that's not even 2023 anymore. It's been going on longer than that. So I guess I would fault NPR for being at least a year behind on their headline, even though it was wrong to start with, because that all happened a while ago. But beyond that, what you're going to see in 2024 is a real push on something called real-world asset tokenization, RWAs. And when I said that an NFT can represent pretty much any asset, it can. And we're now seeing an industry pushing for that to be, and some examples that are out there that people can look up, it could be authenticity of a pair of Nike shoes. It can be a Louis Vuitton handbag. There's a trademark case going on right now between Aramé and somebody over Meta Birkins because somebody decided to do an NFT of Birkin bags, but they didn't have authority to do so. And they should properly get squashed on that front. We have JP Morgan putting bonds out via blockchain. So that covers what I call the rights and obligations of contracting party, which can be represented by NFTs. We're working on some projects that have diamonds that are represented by NFTs. Certainly, precious metals, gold bars in a vault, absolutely. Real property, absolutely. There's really no limit to it. So I'll get back to the metaphor of a piece of paper. You're going to see the paper start getting used in 2024 in ways that the general population can go, oh, I understand that. And that, I think, is actually what's going to drive the next bull run in digital assets. And certainly, I suspect NPR will figure that out somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote an entire academic article in a different life about imprecise terminology and how that it hurts, regulation, this conversation kind of reminds me of when Ted Stevens famously talked about the internet and said it's a series of tubes, right? The analogy, actually, I kind of get the analogy, but it's just difficult for people to wrap their mind around in terms of the whole overall technology. And it's, Josh, in terms of regulators, it's actually hard for them to wrap their head around this as well, right? I mean, ultimately, there's a reason why, having been on the government side of the house before, it's difficult, right? You're not quite sure how to engage with, especially with new technologies and new approaches. What does the Ripple decision say about the SEC? And what does how do you think the SEC is going to react given the fact that, the courts have started to weigh in now?
All right. Well, I'm going to start with the last part first because it's definitely easiest. The administration is going to change and the players at the SEC are going to change and the position of the SEC will change. I feel like the SEC's kind of time of being really problematic has probably passed. The high point has probably gone by. I'm much more worried about the IRS right now. That said, I understand that a decision came out this morning in Terra Luna from the court in Southern District of New York, and I haven't read it yet. So, I know that came out more Gary Gensler, SEC favorable to these things are just, securities, but I haven't read it to see what his logic is yet. So I'll put a small asterisk on that statement. In terms of the bigger question, I think we have a really very big fundamental systemic problem in terms of regulation of technology. And I think it covers really all technology. I don't think it's unique to blockchain. The problem is, as we've been saying for years now, law can't keep up with technology. And it's a truism. If you think about things on a curve, your pace of technology, you usually think of that nice exponential curve. And we're probably actually about here on the hockey stick where we start going vertical. And the pace of legislation in our country, which you can think back to your schoolhouse rock, checks and balances, three branches, all that kind of stuff, and two houses and has to pass the House and the Senate, it goes something like this. It actually takes longer to get stuff done. And on top of that, you've got regulators who are, generally speaking, politicians. They're not trained in this stuff. They certainly don't know about it. And even if they are trying their absolute best to be informed, the best they're going to do is be able to call some experts in to testify for 1 or 2 days to try to educate them, to reach out to some industry groups to, on a, one at a time basis, come and try to educate those folks. And they're fighting against certain other politicians that don't really care and just have a personal agenda, something like maybe nationalizing the financial system. Not that I'm thinking of anybody in particular who I'd love to see just buried. But in any case, that's a problem. And the legislature's reaction to it, which is what they've done time and again, is to go, okay, we need to pass regulation. It's a political process. Something has to happen. So we're going to make compromises and we're going to push stuff off. And you have things like our infrastructure bill that got passed with, you know, provisions in it that certain politicians knew were impossible in terms of, you know, how we were labeling certain IRS, you know, requirements as far as, you know, Bitcoin nodes reporting information that they weren't going to have. Like there's actually transcripts of this stuff. They knew it was impossible. They passed it anyways. And they said, well, you know what? The IRS will figure it out. And that's happened with the SEC also. You know, we've got no legislation on digital assets. Like, oh, you know, the SEC will figure it out. We've got this going with FinCEN, with the, you know, money transmitter stuff. And what happens is that those administrative bodies are in a position where they have to do something. And invariably, somebody jumps in and will do it. And oftentimes, what they end up doing is going well beyond their mandate and actually legislating. And we've got some lawsuits now that are, you know, the first one's actually against the EPA. For rulemaking in excess of legislative authority. And that's a problem because that's a breakdown of three branches of government. And I don't have a solution for it other than to say, well, the courts seem to be looking at it and, you know, hopefully we'll figure something out because, you know, the three branches of government don't work if the legislative branch abdicates its power to the executive branch. Probably that wasn't too technical.
No, I mean that you're correct on every point, right? And sort of understanding that American government, especially lately, is failing miserably. I mean, talk about truisms. Jason, you know, in a nod to our Canadian North, I'll let you talk about what's happening. And that places that aren't America. The question I would ask you though, Josh, is you said at the top of that last statement that this is not unique to distributed ledger technology. It applies to technology generally. So what if you could wave the magic wand? Would be the analogy you'd give to, let's assume there's a functioning legislature. Would you say, hey, you know, DLT is like the internet? Would you say, hey, DLT is like the corporation? Would it be DLT is like the internal combustion engine or steam? Like what would your dream analogy be if you could actually talk to somebody for real?
That's a really super interesting question. You know, the first thing out of my mind was electricity. Because, you know, it is something that, you know, fundamentally makes everything work. But I actually don't know that I'd want it regulated the way electricity is regulated in terms of a public utility commission kind of basis. And there's obviously some different elements. It doesn't have the same resource consumption curve and everything else that you find in regulating electricity. You know, I might say math. You know, it's like math.
Yeah, you can't regulate it, right? Like it's an
you can't regulate it. The fundamental friction here is, you know, if you just think about what the word is, decentralized ledger technology, right? It's distributed ledger technology, but decentralized for this purpose, because, you know, the statement is, well, that it's not surprising that's not friendly to centralized government concepts. You know, the two are somewhat, you know, contradictory. Because the government, you know, loves to maintain a monopoly over information and keep it to itself and then act on it and all that kind of stuff. And even if you think about our constitutional protections, a lot of them are around information, you know, no unreasonable search and seizure, right to privacy. I mean, that's all information related. So, you know, we recognize the importance of it. And what this technology does is it says, okay, you know, the information is public. Everybody can have a copy of it. Everybody sees it. Everybody can use it. And that's going to be a problem because almost every single regulatory scheme does not operate that way. And then you've got, you know, the other thing, which is, you know, by allowing us to do things that way, we also, as a corollary, create our own monetary system. So, you know, the reason that, you know, when Project Libra came out from Facebook, that it was so quickly shut down is because, you know, they can't do anything about Bitcoin, but if Facebook, with its global kind of customer base, sets up a currency that's based on a basket of fiat currencies, that really drives a hole through each government's own ability to regulate by economics by changing interest rates on its own currency. It effectively mutes the entire thing because you know, now all the currencies are being glommed together. So there's no, you know, difference necessarily between them based on what the various governments do. And that was just not something that could be allowed to happen. And that would have been very, very fast if it had been Facebook pushing that adoption, much faster than Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin, everything else, we still have the barriers to consumer entry. It's still complicated. It's still scary. But we are going in that direction. I mean, I don't think there's really, I don't know if it'll end up being a network of CBDCs, central bank currencies. But I think, you know, at some level, there are people who just want to be able to engage in commerce without needing the government to perfectly watch them do it. And that's a natural contradiction, because there are some government functions that I'm personally very much in favor of. I don't want to support terrorism. I don't want to support human trafficking. So, you know, all the KYC stuff, I know your customer, which is, you know, global in scope. A lot of it comes out of the Financial Action Task Force, out of the G20. And I think that that's really important stuff. The catch is that a lot of governments try to use that as a boogeyman to shut down things that they don't otherwise want to have be there. So, it becomes a question of getting the most elegant solution to allow, you know, the maximum of personal freedom from, you know, unwarranted oversight against the fact that you don't want terrorism and human trafficking, et cetera.
I hear that. Like you said at the beginning, like electricity might be the wrong model, even though it's similar to that. I mean, it sounds like if you were to call it, a financial product, so that's regulated like our currency, I guess I should say, so it's regulated like a currency, that's bad for all the centralization reasons.
Yeah, and it also doesn't fit, because your medical records are going to be on this stuff. I mean, your genome can be here. There's so many non-financial use cases.
Yeah. So, I mean, the government's not going to step away, I don't think. Is this truly the harbinger of revolution, or do you have faith that there's going to be sort of a lawful regulatory system of some sort, right? That is this technology truly new, right? I mean, is it different than anything else we've ever done before?
Yeah, well, it is. Okay. It's not a law. I guess I'll answer that in two parts. So just on the is it different than anything else we had? I'll put it this way. If you go back to the dawn of human existence, you might find a person in a cave counting mammoth steaks and berries and axe heads. And that person is a centralized ledger. And if you think about how the tribe functioned, the chief had that information, that person had that information, maybe a couple other people, but on the whole, no, nobody did. And certainly the other tribe didn't have it. That's kind of the way information has been kind of held. And everything from that point through, 2009-ish, has been about centralized ledgers. It's, who has the count? How is the count being made? Can I audit the count? Maybe I need two counts. I need an escrow because I don't trust you with the count. You know, all those types of things. And that's politics, religion, society, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's all around centralized ledgers. So yeah, that's something we haven't seen before. It's also not the only thing we haven't seen before. You know, we're cruising in on artificial intelligence in a real way. We're cruising in on quantum computing in a real way. We've got, technology at a point with Internet of Things where we can, put sensors on pretty much anything anywhere. The data from that can actually be delivered by artificial intelligence through distributed ledger technology in ways that are just amazing when you start putting all this stuff together. So we're heading into a completely new epoch, I guess maybe is the best way to put it. And, what government is going to do with that, I don't know, because what I didn't mention at all was anything like police force or military. The governments have these things. I don't think in general they let power go easily. And I don't know that they should either. The EU made a statement, and this one kind of seems like it went on a little bit under the radar. So to your earlier question, Jason, they made a statement with respect to distributed ledger technology that this stuff needs to be regulated on a global basis. Like they actually said it. That was in context of putting Mika in place, and they're going to come out later with something for NFTs. And from what I've seen, they're absolutely right, because, half of my practice is like, oh, you can't do that in the United States. Let's see which country is going to make sense for you. It's, regulatory arbitrage. And then, you get something done in one place and it's like, okay, well, once it's been going for a few years, that can kind of ooze into a different place in a different way and, get coverage that way. But that's really a stupid way for us to function. I mean, it's got so many negative elements to it in terms of both efficiency and in terms of just, you know, the basic premises and effects. I mean, it would be really nice. But I feel a little bit like the guy after Rodney King saying, can't we all get along? It's like, well, it's not quite that easy. So,
yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because on one hand, you know, there are principles that are really important here, which is like, you know, technology affords us transparency and freedom and the ability to engage in commerce without boundaries, right? Whereas, you know, the government does have core functions that they need to do, right? I mean, the world can quickly turn into a cesspool without any regulation. We're all aware of that. We're all attorneys for a reason, right? So we know that there's some form of regulation that's good. And it's always been very difficult. I think probably what the most difficult thing is right now is the fact that not only are we talking about currency and the flow of capital, but it's also information, it's data. All of that is being conflated into this system. And I think you're right, Josh, and I think the EU is right. You know, in this kind of regime, when all of the things that give us power in this world are now being afforded by technology, it doesn't make sense to really allow us to do this sort of like jurisdictional arbitrage, right? We do need some sort of principles and a global thing. But in the absence of that, Josh, right, because that's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take a long time if it ever happens at all. I've heard words like scary, complicated, messy. For prospective clients out there or existing ones, depending on how you want to do it, what should they be doing in light of the recent regulatory developments here in the United States? What should they be doing in terms of looking at the IRS and their principles? I mean, what are the things to do to protect yourself right now?
That's a great question. So, you know, first and foremost, surround yourself with professionals who actually know what they're doing. Yeah, just like that. But, you know, kidding aside, it's really important. And I think it's actually really incumbent on the various professionals also to get educated. I know in the security space, and I think I see this coming in the tax space also, you know, there's a belief by many attorneys, oh, I know what the law is, and here comes this thing, and I'll apply the law to it. And it really can't work that way. You know, you have to understand the technology, because then you can kind of figure out what you can kind of fit into with the law and kind of what works by analogy, which gets me to kind of what I tell our clients, at least with respect to the securities law and certain other things. You know, number one rule, don't rip people off. Number one rule is don't rip people off. Number two rule is don't give people enough rope to hang themselves. And the reason for those two rules is because securities law at its heart is consumer protection. So, you know, the point is, you know, don't violate the policies underlying what put the law in place in the first place. Because if you don't violate those policies, then chances are you're not going to attract attention. If you do have some kind of a foot fault, they may or may not go after you for it. And if they do go after you for it, the chances are there's not going to be any real damages because you didn't do anything wrong from a, you know, moral kind of objective statement. And then you do the best you can with the letter of the law. And that becomes a question of risk tolerance and mitigation. You know, are you a project that, you know, has public figures in it where you're in the limelight and any little thing is likely to get magnified by the media? Well, you know what? You've got less risk tolerance than somebody who's, you know, coming out of the college dorm and taking a crack at it. And, you know, both maybe not ripping people off, but, you know, the college dorm guys, there's less risk. You know, likewise, some of the big banks are less likely to jump in quickly than, you know, some smaller state chartered credit union out of Wyoming, for instance. That's just kind of a truism. You kind of look at it through your own lens. But that's, you know, the big advice on the IRS front, the tax front. It's a little bit harder because the way the tax system is set up, you know, we've got, you know, decades, if not, you know, centuries of you look at the tax rules and you figure out every possible way you can to optimize for yourself so you pay the government the least money possible. So it's you know, that same idea of don't rip people off, that doesn't really come into play as much. You know, with tax, it's more a question of like, well, what can I do? What are the probabilities that I'm going to, you know, run into trouble? And then what are the, you know, penalties and things of that nature if I do? And that's a much harder set of kind of calculations for me personally. I'm a securities attorney, not a tax attorney, so that's not surprising, I guess. But I would stick with the same general concept across everything, which is look at what the underlying principles are behind the law that you're worried about, and don't violate them. Easy said, hard to do, but that's the thought.
Yeah. One of the things that's, always frustrating for clients is when their attorney tells them it depends, but it really does depend. Ultimately that's what it is. But I mean, overall, I'm glad you mentioned that the blanket principle is try to comply, right? Because, ultimately, working together with professionals and trying to actually have a regime that works is important, because I can tell you, at the end of the day, bureaucrats are people too. And if you're trying to comply and you're trying to demonstrate things in good faith, it does matter, right? Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned, ripping people off, because guess what? You might try to be, Clarence Darrow and do the letter of the law stuff. But at the end of the day, a regulator will see through that. And if they don't like you, guess what? It does matter. It shouldn't, maybe, but it does.
Oh, yeah, no, and it's not even new to this. I mean, just to digress slightly, because I love the thought on this. I've been frustrated for years by tax rules, because I'll over-engineer things all day long. I believe every problem has a solution. But, you get into the tax mechanisms of it, and you do the triple loop-de-loop, step to the side. According to the tax code, this means I pay nothing. Mm. And even if you're right, there's like this final tax law that's like the rule of bullshit. And it says that, like, if we think you're full of shit, you're full of shit. And you appeal that. And it's true. And eventually I learned my lesson on it more than 10 years ago, thankfully, and just kind of went, okay, if I push the envelope too much, they're just going to call bullshit on it. That doesn't really matter whether I'm right or not.
So with all that in mind, right, you've given us the criteria for what a party, client or not, or otherwise, should do it well. And given the tone of this episode, which is sort of the year in review, give us a couple of projects, right, that you think are doing it well. Maybe they're clients, maybe they're not. And then, if you don't mind, for a second part, where do you see an opportunity where it's not being taken advantage of yet?
Okay. My stock answer on projects doing it well is almost always going to be Chainlink. I'm a huge Link Marine. For anybody who doesn't know Chainlink's functionality, they're an Oracle system that's basically providing a truthful source of, information. And usually it's your primary source information that is fed into, various blockchain infrastructure systems to trigger, action by smart contracts. So, it triggers an execution. And it might be, the price of Bitcoin at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Thursday is, 42,000. It might be it's raining over the guava plains in Argentina. If there are such a thing, I don't even know. But anything that's, verifiable primary source information, then can be fed into a system that a blockchain with a smart contract is able to digest it and execute. There's a couple other projects that are in that space. Nobody really even close to them that I know of in terms of, how far they are along. They've got a ton of integrations with the real world. So I'm a big fan there. I hesitate to talk too much about projects that I don't fully know or understand, but I'd be an idiot to ignore what's going on with Solana. I wish I was less of an idiot way back when, because I think it's up something like 770% in 2023, some ridiculous amount. I know that they've got a tech that for a while was taking a little bit of beating. They had some hacks, and I really don't know exactly what they've done to it. But it's a layer one, and there's gonna need to be layer ones. I don't know that ETH 2 is the world beater there. I mean, I think with Bitcoin and ETH 2, they're obviously the originals, but they're also somewhat legacy. And while they can be improved, and they have been improved, and new versions come out, it isn't surprising to me to think that other people along the way think of different ways of doing things, which might be better. And I don't know that I want to call any out in particular, but nonetheless, that is the case. In terms of an opportunity, there are so many opportunities. You know, I feel like, you know, every day I wake up and there's a new, oh my God, you can do this thing going on. I do think 2024 is going to be the year of real world assets, and that, you know, the real driver and along with the halving, probably the driver of, you know, a bull run in digital assets in general is going to be the rapid tokenization of things that have been historically illiquid. And, you know, to give you just a super obvious example of that, diamonds are a great answer. There is not an established diamond market. It's not easy to trade diamonds. And, you know, the methodology of the professionals who deal with diamonds is hundreds of years old. It's still, hey, you know, I'm going to contact this guy and I'm going to see what he's got. And we're going to get together. I'm going to get out my jeweler's loop. And, you know, in terms of how they sell to folks, they consign to each other so that somebody can, you know, have the diamond and show it to a potential client. And none of it allows it to be investable. And part of it is also because, you know, they're not fungible. Every diamond is, quote, unique, or at least so we are told by De Beers. But the thing about that is that if those diamonds don't have to actually move because there's an NFT that is, you know, tagged to each diamond based on a little etching on the girdle of the diamond, which is already kind of how they do serial numbers for gemology reports. And you can just trade those NFTs around, and whoever happens to have the NFT can take delivery when they get around to it. Suddenly you've solved a lot of the problems, and suddenly you might actually unlock the liquidity in the diamond market, which, by the way, would make the whole thing jump up in value tremendously. That's a very big thing. And it's, you know, it's something people are working on already that's happening. So things of that nature. Carbon credits is another one where, you know, we've been working with clients figuring out, you know, methodology for validating, you know, the authenticity of carbon credits, because there's a lot of fraud in that space also. And, you know, NFTs tagged to carbon credits from particular projects have a lot going for them. There's just a lot you can do with it. So these things where, you know, you don't need to understand how a consensus algorithm works. You don't need to understand how a smart contract works. You don't need to know any of that any more than you need to know how paper is made. And it's great if you understand wood pulp and chemicals and all that, but you don't need to. And that's, I think, where we're headed this year. And that's going to drive a lot.
You know, I think of Trading Places, which dates me. But the thing about it is, I think of that scene when they go in and they're trading frozen concentrated orange juice.
Yes.
I think that was the time when I realized, you know, when a younger me realized, oh, you don't actually need to actually have the thing to trade it, right?
Right.
you know, and whereas exchanges were a great way to do it in, you know, the 2000s, you know, and early on. Now that we're in the 21st century, we can actually, you know, we can do more, right? And we can move it, and we don't have to have centralized exchanges to do that, which is exciting. But it is, Josh, a very ethereal concept, right? To sort of for people to wrap their mind around.
Oh, yeah.
And that actually takes me to you know, even like things like IP, right? what is the in 2024? Do you think that, you know, we will first of all understand what it means to have DLT and IP? And do you think there's going to be broader adoption of DLT, you know, in the global IP regime?
So, you know, it's a really interesting question. And what I'm going to say is it's definitely an off the top of my head answer. So I reserve my right to change field on this. I don't think that the two actually have a whole lot to do with each other. And, you know, here's why. Intellectual property conceptually, you know, I think we kind of get it's the stuff that you create out of your mind, whatever. But legally, it's also framework. It's legal framework. You've got a patent act, you've got copyright, you've got, you know, trademark. None of those things really change based on distributed ledger technology. Certainly, you can patent aspects of DLT stuff subject to, you know, Alice and other decisions. You know, trademark is still trademark. It hasn't changed. You know, copyright is still extremely weak. And, you know, it's effectively software. You know, the only thing here, and I'd put it in the category of not a big change, but just it will happen along with everything else, is if you can trade contractual rights and obligations via, you know, NFTs or such, you know, certainly you can license intellectual property that way also, in the same way. You can definitely have, you know, royalties that are paid out by a smart contract, subject to setting up something for tax reporting and know your customer stuff, which we do. But intellectual property just as a subject matter is, strangely enough, one of the things that I don't think is actually super effective. And I know I'm speaking with somebody who's into intellectual property. So you tell me if you kind of disagree, but I mean, sure, the methodology for recording that you've got rights changes. It used to be paper, and it's digital. Okay, now it's recorded in a blockchain. Fine, got it. But I don't really view that as a fundamental shift.
So it's an interesting take. I'm reminded, and I just found the source. Brian Fry is another, and I think this is the right episode, but he was interviewed on another podcast, Bankless, which is a great one.
Yeah,
and he made the interesting point that NFTs can almost destroy the need for copyright, right? Copyright is the centralized registration of rights, and it exists so that creators can, you know, grab those royalties that you were just talking about. NFTs, you know, cut out that middleman. It's sort of the classic use, right? Get rid of the government. We can just do this directly. You don't need your central registry.
Yeah. All right. So I like the Bankless guys, and that sounds like a very Bankless position to take. I don't agree with it, though, because I think it confuses the logistics for the conceptual. From a logistics perspective, yeah, sure. Do you need a centralized filing database? Maybe not. And, you know, it's like any other central repository. I don't think it hurts to have it. I think the law of copyright as it currently exists has, you know, tried to regulate itself by requiring somebody to file the registration in order to claim damages. And I think that was probably a good move, because it really is otherwise just a giant morass. I think what, you know, he may be trying to get at, which is true, is that, you know, the royalty process can be automated. And, you know, you can, with certain, you know, NFT protocols, not 721, by the way, but, you know, different, more technical conversation. But with certain protocols, you absolutely can generate a royalty that is, you know, very difficult to, you know, software code yourself around for, you know, particular uses. But the thing about copyright is, you know, not everything is going to be coming out of an NFT. I mean, you still can't see an NFT. Like your embodiment is never going to be the NFT. The NFT doesn't hold, you know, a copywritten image almost ever. Bitcoin ordinals, slight exception, but they're, for other reasons, practically useless at this point. But, you know, your actual copywritten image is going to be, you know, held somewhere in IPFS or an Amazon cloud. Maybe you printed it out and you've got a copy of it on your desk. You know, you can still show it by video. So, you know, people don't see NFTs in the sense of like seeing a piece of paper. And the image itself is not the NFT. So I have to think about it a little bit more. I'm just thinking about it now, but I don't think I agree with that statement.
Hmm. Well, I'm, you know, not going to argue with you or against Bankless or against you and for Bankless. I'll let them do that. But copyright's sort of unique, right? And I guess Jason's question, what does DLT do to intellectual property, is huge, because intellectual property itself is huge, right? Talking about, you know, getting away a little bit from distributed ledger technology and talking instead about another technology we were talking about, that's AI. Mm-hmm. And we've had a couple of conversations with a couple of different guests about, oh, you know, artificial intelligence and its capabilities and its possibilities. But, you know, famously or infamously, the Supreme Court recently held that it's, you know, artificial intelligence cannot be an inventor for purposes of patent. There is a little, I mean, similar idea when it was that primate that took a picture of itself and they held that it couldn't be an author for those same reasons. If you could talk a little bit about artificial intelligence, right? And its possibilities, the impact of that case, I think specifically on IP, if you don't mind being specific, but then feel free.
Sure. So, all right. The first thing I want to set up is that the reason for those decisions is not inherent to the nature of intellectual property. It's inherent to the wording of the statutes that provide those laws, which specifically state that it is a product of human invention or whatever it is. And I think we're probably written at a time before anybody was thinking about any of this. So I almost have to call that chance. Now, that said, it kind of makes sense, because very much like in patent, you can't patent a product of nature. And I think that, you know, the question comes down to, from an artificial intelligence perspective, well, okay, is, you know, a product of artificial intelligence similar to something created by a force of nature? I think that's a good way to put it. And, you know, the way the decisions have come down actually, I think, is correct, which is to say that, you know, putting the monkey thing aside for a second, you know, it takes a certain, you know, if you've ever gone on any of the AIs, it takes a certain level of skill with prompting to use them in any kind of meaningful way. And where the courts are coming out, which is, I think, is the right place, is that, you know, if you think about the AI as basically, you know, painting implements, you know, it's paint, it's canvas. If you just throw stuff onto the canvas and it happens to be hitting, you hit something randomly, should that, you know, get protection? Well, probably not. That's like, you know, what happens when rain hits the dirt and it leaves a particular pattern. If the amount of prompting that you have to do and skill behind it is such that, you know, a person of ordinary skill would not just be able to get at it randomly, does that deserve protection? Well, yeah, it probably does. It probably does. Because that, at that point, you know, even though you've got artificial intelligence as a tool, you've got a person using that tool. And, you know, I think that that's probably the right way for it to go. And as I understand it, I haven't really focused on those decisions quite as much, but I think that that's the way that they've generally gone.
That's my understanding as well. They're sort of treating it like a tool. I think you're right. It's an accident of history. I think certainly for patent, the Supreme Court focused on inventor, where I don't think it says human inventor, but I think it says inventor. And I think they thought, well, the founders clearly meant human, for the reason you mentioned. I think it's thorny for sure, right? It can't be the end, because I mean, artificial intelligence, while it's a tool, is itself sort of protectable through intellectual property. And if we're saying, okay, our artificial intelligence is just software, I think that has implications that we don't want. Whereas if we say it's more than software, it goes the other way.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be called just software, and that would be a mistake, because I think software, you know, every NFT is also software, and that's, you know, its own thing. It's a bad term, but you know, when we get to the point where we've got, you know, sentient artificial intelligence, you know, then we're going to have a much more interesting discussion.
How do you find sentience, Josh? For a quick question.
Oh well, why don't we just bring on the guys from Google and they can talk all about how to define sentience. we don't have enough time for that discussion. And I'm not the right guy. It's not my specialty. But the point I'm making is that you're at that point breaking away from any potential human inventorship claim. You know, if it's not sentient, you know, whoever invented the AI can say, oh, this is a product of the tool that I created, it's mine. Or you can have, you know, the user say, oh, I used this tool and I created it, it's mine. If you've got, you know, sentient AI that, you know, no human being has touched the process in, you know, 50 iterations or whatever, and it just kind of said, oh, I did this. Then you've got the question of whether the sentient AI is entitled to some type of protection. And I think right now that's a clear no. But, you know, this is the stuff that the science fiction books I read as a child are about. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, Skynet is not here yet. You know, the Matrix is not real yet. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, we've got some very clever language learning models and you know, some other goodies that are being baked on top of that. But we are still a little whiles away.
And by the way, I don't know that I agree with you that the Matrix is not here yet, and I challenge you to prove your statement.
Well, yes, we could all be living in a gigantic simulation, and that was an idea that I had since I was a kid. But, you know, I choose. It's easier for me to pretend it isn't. I am definitely a Joe Pantoliano's character there. I'd rather believe that the steak that I'm eating is real rather than not. So, you know, what can you do?
You do.
So. Josh, you know, with, you know, mentioning time and, you know, we're near the end of our hour, in terms of 2024, looking forward, right? What are some of the projects that most excite you, whether that's something that you're associated with or whether that's independently out there? You know, what's next in 2024 that really gets you going?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to answer that in kind of a general item and calling back to kind of what the EU said about global regulation. I am right now very excited about anything that materially pushes global technical integration. I think that there's a lot, particularly in commerce, but in some other areas also, where geographic sovereign borders really get in the way. And there's no real need for it. You know, you could almost say, I almost feel like we're a little bit like the 13 colonies before the Constitution was written, except that that's every country in the developed world, and we don't have a global federal equivalent, if you will. And I don't expect that that's going to change. I don't know that I necessarily want it to change. There's a lot more to that. But I do know that, you know, there's a lot of friction in commerce and other freedoms that don't need to be there. So without getting into anything in particular, and part of it is because I'm trying to remember what's confidential and what's not, you know, the thing is that, you know, ease some of those burdens by, you know, stitching together systems that are not otherwise stitched together, you know, things that governments do that they do because of an accident of history, not because they have to. So, you know, patent office is a great example. Like, you know, why is that broken down by country? Like, what real service is it that, like, every patent needs to be patented in a separate country? And by the way, then you get to pay maintenance fees in all those countries also. And, like, actually patenting something globally and maintaining it is something you can only do if you're, like, a large corporation. You know, that in my the legal terminology, that's bullshit. That is a problem that should not exist. Anything that takes those types of things, that's something that excites me.
Well said. Well, that's something to look forward to. Philip, any final thoughts or questions?
No, I appreciate it, Josh, spending the time helping us wrap our head around all these new and interesting things. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, of course.
Yeah, and I'm going to do a little prognostication and say that you'll be back, Josh. We'll have to discuss.
And, say that.
And looking forward to it. So happy New Year, and we will see you very soon.
All right, happy New Year, guys. Take care.